Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
So welcome everyone. This is a special day in a couple of ways. It's the end of a week of talking about, about these remarkable Chinese nuns, Chan nuns in the 17th century. So we've been doing that, and it's also the Buddha's birthday, if everybody remembers that as well. And for me, it's a couple of special days. Thank you. It's a couple of special days because it's the 49th day after my teacher from the monastery passed away. And so this is a very special time as a memorial for me personally. And also, on top of that, this is the anniversary of my becoming an Osho. I was made Osho on April 8th as well, 11 years ago. So a lot of things coming together for me right now. And we've been talking, we talked for the first 3 days about Jing Gong, amazing teacher, who had seven women Dharma heirs, and one of those Dharma heirs is Yi Kui, who we've been talking about yesterday and today. These are both women that became teachers. They became serious students of Chan or Zen at a time in China when it was in great upheaval. For those of you that haven't been here yet, one of the remarkable things about a time of chaos such as this, when the Ming Dynasty was falling apart and the Manchus were taking over China, a lot of upheaval societally, and it's a good opportunity for women to kind of step into the breach and take opportunities to train where they might not have been able to before. So that's the time that we are looking at. And Yi Kui, Koshin started us out with her and got us to the point where she's been ordained. She's been training with Jing Gong at the lion-subduing cloister. And then she left the cloister and went back to her own family estate and built a hermitage and was quite happily sitting away there. When the two other disciples of Jing Gong, who had been running the Lion Subduing Cloister after Jing Gong died, one died and the other said, "I need help. Can't do this by myself. Please come." And Yi Kui didn't want to come. She was quite happy sitting in her little hermitage, and so she didn't want to come. But in the end, she had to, because there were several things that the students of Jing Gong were really obligated to do in that society. Build a stupa for her, and that, having experienced this in the Tibetan tradition now, this is quite a production. Raising the funds and setting up the how it's going to be built and where it's going to be built and how it should face and all sorts of detail about that. So it's a big deal. And so she went back to help with that. And then, of course, the disciple who had been there had died, so there's yet another stupa that has to be built. And then the third person, the one who had invited her, also died. So anyway, she spent 6 years at the Lion Subduing Cloister running that, and completing the building of these memorial stupas. And as she had promised was, I'm going to do that and then I'm done, I'm going back. So she went back to her own cloister, which she called Joining the Three. And by that she meant joining Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism, all these traditions in China. She had originally actually wanted to build the stupas at her place so she didn't have to go. but that didn't work out. So there's always more people to answer to than just yourself. So she moved back home, and her very close sibling, her older brother, Sun Zilin, was there. They had actually been practicing together. She was introduced to Xingong by her older brother, in fact. And so he very much supported her practice. And when she came back, he helped her expand it so that she could bring students in. And she did bring in, just like Xingong, she was a very good teacher. She was highly thought of, brought in a lot of students, men and women, lay and ordained. They all trained with her. But just as with Xingong, over time, as she grew older, and she was never in really very good health, she began to really feel quite sick. Fatigue, she wasn't able to swallow well. When she stopped being able to swallow well, she decided she wasn't going to eat anymore, that it was a sign her body was giving her. So she stopped eating and called her four senior students to take over for her. And she gave each of them a different responsibility. One was kind of the spiritual director, running the spiritual program, the training aspects of the program. Two were teachers. And the fourth person kind of focused on the administrative aspects. Both of these women were really quite skilled, Xingong and Yikui, at understanding what was necessary to keep a place like this going. So, of course, as is the way it's supposed to be, is you're supposed to write a death poem before you die. And so her students begged her to write a death poem. She protested. She didn't want to write a death poem and refused to. Please write a death poem. And so finally she said, well, I'll write something about why I'm not going to write a death poem. So I like this because it kind of expresses to me what I feel of her personality. So this is her protest death poem. Our lineage teaches non-dependence on words and letters. The Honored One preached the Dharma for 49 years without ever uttering a single word. If I were to produce words and phrases, this would be slandering the Dharma. Now each of you can take something from my wordless words. So that was her protest poem. And her students begged and begged. They said, please write a real death poem. So finally she said, all right, I won't read that because it's actually quite long. She had a lot more to say than she thought, which is often the case. So she said, I'm going to die at a certain time on a certain day, and in fact that's what happened. She chose that day, and that's the day she died. And we don't know too much about what happened to these the nuns, the students of these two women over time. The cloisters kept going for a while, the Lions of Doing Cloister kind of declined, and then it was built back up again. But then they're not in the record. It's a mystery. I mean, they might still be there. We don't know. Or there might not be any buildings. Who knows? But we're really dependent on the records, the written records, to know all that. But that's the nature of things anyway, that even though these were wonderful places to train, and as a woman I would think, boy, I would have loved to have an opportunity to do some training with either of these two women. That's just not going to happen, so we can at least appreciate the poems and writings that they've left us. So I'd like to go to the poem, and feel free to look at yours as well. I'll read each of the lines too. You probably noticed this is pretty dense with imagery. This is a very typical Chinese classical poetry style where each phrase recalls a lot of different things. It may be referring back to earlier poems, it may be referring to stories, things that would have been common knowledge then, which to us it can seem rather opaque. Mm-hmm. So some of these images feel rather busy. I could spend hours going through this with you, but I'm not going to cover all of those, but try to hit the main points and the point she's trying to make. What about this Chan meditation? Once the layered gates are shattered, any place is a place of tranquility. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things become pure. And this is what we've been talking about all week. It's what we've been working on all week, those of us who've been sitting together, is settling our minds, calming our minds, not pushing things away, but allowing them naturally to settle. And she uses the term layered gates. Once the layered gates are shattered, a gate can be seen as a gate or it can be seen as a barrier, you know? I mean, if we look at it and say, oh, that means I can't go there, we see it as a barrier. If we see it as a gateway, oh, this is telling me I can go through. So we can see the same object in two different ways. And we can see episodes of our life in several different ways, too. It all depends on the perspective. And once we're able to be flexible about how we work with things and have that broader perspective, we become free to move in all directions. So what had been a barrier becomes a gate. In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of a pine tree, watching as the toad in the moon slowly rises to hover in the east. The pine tree represents the Rinzai tradition. And I know at Daibosatsu Zendo and also Genki Roshi would always plant a pine tree for a new Osho. Now, at DBZ, most of them died. So it was an issue for the gardeners. It was a constant stress taking care of these pine trees, which were in the wrong location. So it was more about, yes?
I just have to tell you, I just went to Japan and to Myoshinji and Daitokuji. Uh-huh. I talked to Yuho, Tom Kirshner. We were looking at the pines.
Uh-huh.
And he said, a lot of these die.
Yes.
He said, because they're not supposed to be here. They're supposed to be on the coast.
That's right. Yes.
So well, even there.
These poor babies were sitting on a pile of glacial rock. Just need a little more nourishment. Not even a pine tree can grow in there. So, anyway, sitting upright in the shade of a pine tree and talking about the moon again represents enlightenment in this classical Chinese imagery. So she's talking about that. The Rinzai tradition has really brought me to seeing the moon clearly. That's a high praise she gives. Don't worry about the toad. That's a long story. Just think of the man in the moon. Maybe that'll work for us. When one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is only confused by things. So she's making the contrast between speaking free of thought, free of trying to figure things out. And if we can speak from a deeper place than up here, or our worries about how we're going to be received, we have a lot more freedom, again, to maneuver verbally just as we have the freedom to walk through gates freely, we have this freedom to speak freely and really speak from the depths. But once we get caught on those thoughts and storylines, once deliberating and debating, we get confused, we get trapped again. Immediately, we get trapped again. With the right opportunity and good fortune, nothing is impossible. Knocking on emptiness, extracting the marrow, becomes a way of life. So right opportunity and good fortune, by this she means our karmic circumstances, the causes and conditions that come together to bring us to this time, this place, this circumstance in our lives. Some of those we know, we can name them, but we can never say, this is why I'm doing this, because there's so many other factors that come in that we really, frankly, have no idea of the ways in which we're being supported, the ways in which we're being hindered, the materials that have come along for us. But she's saying the right opportunity and good fortune. You know, we need to be grateful that we have this opportunity. It's a precious opportunity. Knocking on emptiness, extracting the marrow, becomes a way of life. When she says extracting the marrow, she's referring to a story about Bodhidharma, the first Zen patriarch in China. He came from India to China and brought this emphasis on seated meditation as a practice. He tested his top three disciples with questions, you know, these huato or koan questions. And the first disciple answered, and this was the least skilled disciple, he answered the question and he said, okay, you've grasped my skin. You've grasped my skin. You kind of got the idea, right? The second person, he said, okay, you've grasped my bones. You've gone a little deeper. You know, that's good. You don't just kind of get the idea, but you have some experience, some deep experience of that. And the third answer by Eno Huiko was silence. That was his answer. And Bodhidharma said, you have grasped my marrow. You really have gotten as deep as it gets. And there are no words for that. We put words at it, but we can't really get to the marrow. And so knocking on emptiness is what she says. We can. Oh, that's all we can do in terms of being able to say what it is that's going on. It's knocking on emptiness. Extracting the marrow becomes a way of life. At some point, it's not possible to step back away from this practice. Once we have some sense of how things really are in the world, we can't go back. We have times when we kind of fall off and we get confused, but we know we're confused. We know we're not operating the way we should be operating. We know how to be in balance, and we can come back to that. It becomes a way of life. How wonderfully sublime to discuss mysteries layered like clouds. It is truly rare to meet someone who can be called a kindred soul. She wrote, Yikui wrote that lovely poem that you read about a friend sitting with a Dharma sister and how much she enjoyed their Dharma companionship. And I believe she also felt this with her older brother. They were very, very close. Very close. Almost like twins is my sense, that they had that kind of a connection. And she's saying, to be able to do that, to be able to say, yeah, what can you say? Yeah, that's wonderful to have people that you can communicate with like that, and to discuss these mysteries layered like clouds. There's a number of images like that, layered like clouds, ranks of mountains, to kind of give us the sense that we can always go deeper and deeper and deeper into things. I have a scroll right now hanging in my tea room. It's one of my favorites. It says, "Deep in the mountains, the snow has not yet melted." There's always these little nooks and crannies, and around in the Cascades, you can, if you hike high enough, there'll be little patches of snow even in July under the mountains, under the trees up there. And that's the feeling that I get from this scroll. And it also reflects this, that there's always more. There's always more mystery. We can never say, "Oh, I got it." We can't ever. There's not the final word on this. "I got it." More, more, more. We can always do more. And to have friends who understand that, that's wonderful. So this next line, "The red stove blazes forth with an extraordinary determination, as if it possessed the karmic power to turn the Dharma wheel." Now that might seem like a kind of random image all of a sudden. This one I'm going to explain a bit. In Chinese folklore, the importance of the kitchen god or the stove god, it's really key. Excuse me. It's really key to appease the kitchen god, because your family's good fortune depends on that. And the stove, the hearth, is the center of the home, right? So when she says the red stove blazes forth, she's talking about a good hearth blazing forth, very strong. And traditionally, of course, the firstborn son would inherit, they say inherit the stove. What they mean is the stove and the house it's in. But that's how important the stove was. The first son gets the stove of the family. Obviously, you can't cut it up into pieces and give it to all the other sons, too. But what they do is, I had never heard this before, but when I looked it up, they said the other sons, when they leave home, they will take live coals from the fire in the stove in a bucket, take it to their new home, and use those to start the fire. So it's a symbolic transmission of the stove and the energy of the stove. So if you were at this time, you would hear that, and that's the image you would have of it being the lineage of the family and the legacy of the family. And there's a little something else here, I think. Her rebellious nature shows up a little bit. It may be a slight dig, as I read it, to the patriarchy, thinking, you guys think you pass it along. We can do it. Women don't get these calls. You become part of somebody else's family. You don't get to start your own family. But just a little bit of a dig, I think, in choosing this image, because it's so strongly male to say, so the stove blazes forth with extraordinary determination, as if it possessed the karmic power to turn the Dharma wheel. No, not just you guys. We're there too. I think that's her little thing. "This toiling life, disordered and confused by lust, greed, and anger, but when the mind flower suddenly opens, the world becomes spring." So we can get bound up in the daily grind, you know, and we get drawn back into those three poisons: greed, anger, and delusion. Lust, greed, and anger, she puts it. But all these ways in which we don't act from our deepest grounding. She's really saying you have to stop and do this kind of work in order to allow the mind flower to open. And when it opens, when the flower opens, the world becomes spring. This is a line, it's again a very important tea scroll line. One plum blossom and the whole world is fragrant with spring. I love this image. It doesn't take much for it to change our whole perspective on things. Just take the time, step aside from the daily grind to do this. It's critical work. And it doesn't take much, but it can color our whole life. If we let it, it can color our whole life. Melting snow to boil water for tea, I while away the entire day, feeling inside as vast and expansive as the icy cold moon above. She's coming back to just the ordinary things. Melting snow to boil water for tea. After we've been refreshing and replenishing and deepening ourselves in this way, these simple things just become so special. A tiny boat in the moonlight stirs up foam flowers on the water. Blossoming water lilies send across their fragrances in the dark. I'm not going to go into this. This is another long image that has a lot in it, but more of the same flowering. We'll go with that for now. Hearing, seeing, knowledge, and consciousness are all one dharma. Now this nun can afford to be lazy and let her hair grow long. So all of these things that we do, our perceptions, our mental formations, our thoughts and our emotions, our thinking, none of these, they're all one dharma. She's saying they're not separate from what we're experiencing when we sit and deepen ourselves. We think they are because it feels different when we get out and we get shut in by confusion, but they're not separate. Even that confusion itself is not separate. And to be able to fully appreciate our own mistakes, our own confusion, our own upset, our own grief, all of these things, this too, she's saying. And when we get to this point, she says, now this nun can afford to be lazy and let her hair grow long. So instead of shaving her head every 2 weeks the way we do at the monastery, she's saying, we've used the form, we're transcending the form, we can move beyond it and move freely. So that's the poem. I wanted to tell you a story because this is going back when I said this is a very special day for me because it's the anniversary of becoming an Osho. I feel a little bit sad to be leaving these women, you know. It's been fun kind of being with them and working to feel their personalities come up through the poems and you know, a little bit of jealousy. Wouldn't it have been fun to have been there then and have that experience. I went to a women's college, and I liked that experience. The only thing about the monastery was I had the bathroom all to myself. So, this is going back a long time, and I was reminded of it with Koshin talking about his recent trip to Kyoto. And I lived in Japan. I taught, and I lived and taught in Tokyo when I was right out of college, very young. But I stayed in Kyoto in the school breaks because I have cousins who lived there. They'd been there for a couple of generations at that point. So I would go stay with them on the school break rather than hang out at the school where I was teaching. And a friend of mine came, the second summer I was there, a friend of mine came from the States. And we were traveling around, and we had gone for a walk to a little lake and ran into these. Now, I was 21 and she was 23. We're unattached, so this is okay. But the three very good-looking young men who we got talking with them, and it turned out they were newly minted police officers in the Kyoto Police Force. And they said, oh, you know, we have a day off tomorrow. How would you like to go on a picnic with us? Then we can take the train a couple stops. There's a bigger lake. We can hang out there, you know, and have a good time. Sounded good to me. And so they all worked the night shift, so because they were new cops. So they said, well, when we get off our shift, you know, we'll meet you at this place and we'll have like an early lunch, because then they had to sleep before their next shift. So we met them, but there were only two men there when we got there. And we said, where's the other guy? He was really cute. And they said, oh, well, we're actually gonna go pick him up. He had something that he had to do. Something came up last night during his shift, and he wanted to talk to the priest at his temple, his home temple, about it. And what was it? And they said, it was a pretty grisly murder. And it was, you know, a murder is hard on any cop. This was the first time he was a new cop, first time he'd ever been in a situation like this. It was actually the first time he'd ever seen a dead body. And to see it at that time was really hard for him. And so he felt a strong need to talk to his teacher at the temple, the priest at his temple. They said he really likes this priest and depends, relies on them for instruction. And now, my Japanese wasn't all that good. They were using some words that I didn't understand in there. Osho was one of them. They were calling, this person is what? Osho? Oh, that means sensei. It means teacher. Okay, so teacher, right? Okay. So they said, we're going to go to the temple, sit out front, and so that he'll come out and you know, maybe we'll be lucky and meet the priest, too. I'd never met a Zen priest before. So we went, this tiny little temple. It's like a little postage stamp, like a dollhouse kind of temple. Beautiful, immaculate. In the garden, it was like every little bit of moss was hand-teased, and just gorgeous, but tiny. And finally, the policeman came out, the young man, and behind him was the priest. And I was shocked. I mean, bald head, of course, I expected that. Pure white robes, and it was a woman. The first Zen priest I met was a woman. And I just didn't expect that at all. And she came out, and she had this lovely grin and smile lines that just went all the way out to the next house, just about. I mean, she was brilliant. And very, very warm and kind of earthy. And he introduced us, and, you know, we bowed. And she said, I understand you're going on a picnic, you know. What do you have for lunch? She wanted to know what we had brought for lunch. Oh, that sounds delicious. Have a wonderful time. It's a beautiful day for a picnic. That was the entire exchange. She went back in her temple, and we went off, and the young man's friends asked him, they said, you know, did she help you? Because this was important to them. And he said, yeah. And the only piece of what he talked about karma, that much I got. I didn't understand the detail, but I did understand her saying that, yes, have compassion for the man who was killed and his family, of course, left behind, but also have compassion for the murderer because he's acting out of confusion. So she said, please have some compassion for him because he was concerned about how he should see the whole picture. She said, this is how you should see it, is everybody involved here deserves your compassion. And that kind of struck me, but I've forgotten about her because it was really such a small thing. But then I think to myself, what if I had never met her? You know, when I asked Genki or Roshi to ordain me, It might never have occurred to me if I hadn't seen a woman priest before. I might have thought, well, it looks like just men can be priests, because that's all I ever saw after that. But somehow, that seed was planted. So I will leave you with that, that whatever we do can plant a seed. It is our job to this is the gardener in me speaking, to tend the soil in which you grow those seeds, so that as you sprinkle them throughout the world, they're going to have the most benefit. This is such important work we do.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.